Welcome to Crown and Crozier. I'm your host, Patrick Brown. For this episode, we talk with Dr. Douglas Farrow. Farrow has been a university lecturer and professor for nearly 30 years, with most of that spent at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, where he serves as professor of theology and ethics. Among the most well-known of his many publications are the books Nation of Bastards, Essays on the End of Marriage, Ascension Theology, and Desiring a Better Country. That last title has recently been appropriated by the good professor and applied to his new blog on Substack. If you've had the joy of reading his blog, you'll know that Dr. Farrow is passionate about what he sees as the significance of everything that's happened in the public square over the past 2 years in the COVID pandemic and on the fundamental questions that have been raised about what it means to be human. In our discussion, we also touch on what it's like to live in a place where a prerequisite for getting through the door at your local parish is flashing your vaccine passport, and on the convoy of trucks that recently ensconced itself in downtown Ottawa. Speaking of the convoy, some brief housekeeping items. The trucks rolled into Ottawa on January 29th, 2022. We booked this interview in advance of that and ended up recording it on February 4th, at a time when the situation with the convoy was still fluid. As such, we wanted to keep the focus on what our guests had to say about COVID-related restrictions and mandates, which are the focus of the convoy's protest. With respect to the convoy itself and how to apply Catholic principles to the specific means the truckers are using as their form of protest, drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or email. Let us know if you'd like us to explore these questions in a future episode. Thanks for tuning in. Please be sure to follow us on social media or give us a rating wherever you get your podcasts. And without further ado, enjoy this installment of the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, at God's first.
Joining us for this installment of Crown and Crozier is Dr. Douglas Farrow. Dr. Farrow, a warm welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
In itself, it is a real pleasure to chat with you today. Doubly so, given that we're catching you at a time when I think it's safe to say you're pretty fired up right now. I say that in reference to the blog that you recently started on Substack, Desiring a Better Country. We'll be sure to include a link to it in the show notes. And in that blog, you've been tackling head on some of the most pressing issues of the day in relation to the deeper, more fundamental, more troubling significance of what's actually been taking place over these past 2 years in the midst of the COVID pandemic. And you've been looking at things from a wide variety of perspectives, political, cultural, historical, ethical, spiritual, just to name a few. Reading your reflections over the past few weeks, it's been a real source of joy and comfort for me, as I know it's been for many family members and friends. And along the way, I've been reminded of the admonition that St. Ignatius of Loyola reportedly gave to his Jesuit brethren, Ite inflammate omnia, go and set the world on fire. And as I just mentioned, you know, reading your work, I can't but help think, I mean, this guy's on fire. So what ultimately moved you to want to express your thoughts through this particular medium at this particular time?
Well, the immediate trigger was the Quebec government demanding of the Catholic churches that they institute a vax pass barrier at the door and exclude those who would not present one or could not present one. This I had criticized when it first began to appear as a possibility. I had been very critical writing a piece in Crisis magazine when the first Canadian bishops started to make promises that they would do that. That was in other provinces. When it actually happened here, just before Christmas, I was already prepared theologically, and I hope in some fashion spiritually, to speak out against this as a fundamental contradiction of what the church is, and as a fundamental betrayal of the church's own proper liberty vis-a-vis the state. to say nothing of the betrayal of constitutional rights and freedoms in this country. So I decided that I would have to speak out immediately and identify the nature of this problem. I had already done so, as I said, but I felt I needed to do so locally. And it couldn't wait for the normal editorial and slotting processes that might take place in something like Crisis or Catholic World Report or other places I had written. The other difficulty is that some of the things that had to be said are difficult for some editors to allow because they face boards and supporters, etc., who don't want to hear somebody saying the really difficult things. So I decided it was time that I simply had a site where I could speak freely and speak in a timely fashion. And my wife had for some time encouraged me to consider going on Substack, as had some colleagues in various places. This was the nudge that brought that into reality. So I immediately opened a page and began this enterprise. And it was aided by friendly parties who would occasionally tweet out that the articles were there. And so this helped draw some attention to it, and off we went.
Well, we're grateful for everyone who gave you a friendly nudge or shove somewhere along the way. One of the things that I love about your postings, I mean, you are speaking directly with no inhibitions to the big basic questions with which so many folks are wrestling today. Just what the heck is going on? How do I make sense of this? And what am I called to do in response? Let's take some of those one thing at a time. We're 2 years into a global pandemic. So much of our world, our lives, arguably it's been subverted and inverted. We've seen fundamental freedoms curtailed in the name of health and safety. Basic social interactions are now walled in by any number of restrictions. And it seems safe to say many parts of the West and the world, people are reaching a tipping point. As I say, at this moment, as we speak, we got a convoy of trucks hunkered down just up the road here in Ottawa, demanding an end to all the mandates in Canada. So basic question, just what the heck is going on? How do we make sense of this?
Well, I've been wrestling with that question since March of 2020, as many of us have, but I have been able to put a lot of time into reading and researching and exploring this phenomenon that we've been experiencing. As any of my readers will know, I've reached some time ago conclusions about it which go well beyond positing bureaucratic fumbling and bumbling to seeing patterns around the world which clearly show, well, what I would consider malice aforethought, at any rate, demonstrate planning and purpose. So I've tried to both to keep track of local statistics, Canada, Quebec, occasionally other countries, to see whether the reporting and the messaging from the governments actually correspond to the data that is regularly gathered. Like many people, and with the help of people who are much more adept at this than I am, and much better known than I am in these matters, have concluded very early on that the situation was being misrepresented. And I found that some of my own rough calculations as to the degree of misrepresentation were being confirmed by some of the early studies that were coming out. And that never really changed very much. Even to this day, where I live in Quebec, not so far from you, the government, and this is typical of these of governments around the world, have been presenting data that is in ways that skew the public perception of the facts. So with deaths, for example, I realized very, very early that these were much exaggerated in terms of their connection with COVID And I was just checking this afternoon on the latest Quebec data, and it remains the fact that the vast majority of people categorized as dying with or from COVID, and we'll talk about that distinction, which is by now coming more into focus even for the general public. The vast majority of these people are over 80. They're people who are dying at the normal time people die, and dying in a fashion that is not frightfully different than they normally do at that age. So once I realized that the government was presenting as a crisis what was actually a fairly normal process of very old and vulnerable people falling prey to a virus or to the pneumonia that the virus might lead to, I, of course, became suspicious as to their motives. Why would you do this? Surely a government is, you know, has as part of its natural responsibility to calm people's fears and say, well, yes, you know, there's a risk here to certain categories of people, and they're not all just the very old and very frail. They are other people, sometimes much younger, with comorbidities, but they make up only a tiny slice of the mortality figures. And so once you get in perspective the fact that this has been a virus that has in some ways been better than other viruses, seasonal viruses, because it has tended to leave the healthy young alone and has concentrated in terms of its, you know, I'm personifying it, but has concentrated its efforts on people who are already very frail or very vulnerable because of other conditions, and that it's not been having the effect of an unusual amount of mortality. And when you add to that what became clear again fairly early, that they weren't making a distinction between with COVID and from COVID, they were using the PCR tests at very high cycles to often ramp up the so-called case numbers. And if you came to the hospital and you had one of those tests, which you would have to, and you showed positive, then you were a COVID casualty, even though it had nothing to do with COVID. And so there was just enough of that information quite early on, and it kept mounting over the last 2 years, to lead any reasonable person, it seems to me, to have to question the motives. What is going on? Why is it going on? And the other factor there was the constant pumping of fear propaganda rather than the expected effort to keep the population calm and to target the vulnerable for protection and leave others to go about their business, the move to lockdowns, all of that stuff. And frankly, what we're seeing in the Freedom Convoy and other such protests is that large numbers of people have finally figured out, if they hadn't figured it out before, they've figured it out now, that there's something fundamentally wrong with the way the governments are approaching the whole business. And that in turn leads to questions as to why.
So let's explore that further. I mean, you've looked at this extensively, as I say, from numerous angles and perspectives. Based on all of that extensive work, what conclusions have you reached in terms of discerning the most credible and plausible basis for the motive underlying action on the part of civil authorities?
There's a danger in generalizing, of course, why a chief medical officer is saying something. Maybe the reason may be different than why the premier is saying it. And the premier's reason may be different from that of people at the WHO or at the CDC or its equivalent. So there is a danger of generalizing. At the same time, the coordination of the messaging at all those levels and the coordination of it internationally so that memes suddenly appear around the world at the same time. Pandemic of the unvaccinated, or build back better, or whatever it is, appears simultaneously around the world. This again suggested to me that there are players who are not themselves appearing in public very often, but who are coordinating this because somebody has to be coordinating it. Now, that said, the motivation for being on narrative will vary with different people. For a media person, it might just be that their boss tells them to, or it might be that they love running with the herd. It might be a means of advancement in their career. And that could be true, mutatis mutandis, for medical people or politicians or economics with people who own businesses and who are in league with other people who own businesses and who need to play the game the way that it's intended they should play it. But people's motivations do differ. Some of them probably are too, well, frankly, too thick to even understand what's happening. Others are just not very competent. But as I said at the beginning, I don't think something that's been coordinated to the degree that it evidently has been coordinated around the world can be put down simply to incompetence or to local ambition of, you know, politicians to have powers that they didn't normally have. All of that feeds in and factors in, but it isn't, in my judgment, adequate to explain the global nature of this. Even for example, at the outset in March, when so many people were dying in the care homes, in the long-term care homes, because people with COVID were being sometimes sent from the hospitals to the care homes, knowing that they would infect other people, and drugs were being sent with them that are used in medical aid and dying regimes. That happening in more than one jurisdictions not normally closely connected, suggests that there was a plan for there's a plan for dealing with the crisis, but also a plan for using the crisis to generate changes. So I mean, there are a lot of questions we haven't answered yet and probably won't be answered for some years. But there are certainly questions that need to be pressed. And some of them go to questions of accountability and crime and punishment.
One of the questions that you've been exploring in several of your postings as it relates to potential motives on the part of some of these actors, you've essentially argued that in terms of trying to understand what's going on, in some ways, you got to understand that a lot of this boils down to a fundamental debate around what it means to be human. And you've talked in some of your postings around things like the measures put in place by different authorities, essentially signaling or essentially resting on the premise that citizens are nothing but biometric data points, the merging of man and medicine. I mean, it seems like we're grappling with fundamental questions around what it means to be human. Do we consist of a body and soul? If we do, what's more important? Or do we even have a soul? Can you speak a little bit more to those themes?
Let me then make a bridge between what I was just saying and what I will try to say about that. How we treat one another is determined in part by what we think we are and what we think a human being is. And if we adopt the view that a human being is a rational soul with a body in its service, a composite creature of body and soul, but with the soul as the most essential component, without any demeaning of the body, indeed appreciation of the body as essential to the human, but focused on the flourishing of the whole human being as body and soul. We will not let our lives be controlled by fear of what might happen to our bodies. We will not let our public health policies override all the other considerations of human flourishing, which is exactly what's happened in the last 2 years and why we're not flourishing. Now, if we don't pay any attention to the rational soul and the nature of the human being as a rational, voluntary agent, then we may very well decide to determine our policies and procedures for lesser ends than the flourishing of the whole human being. Now, those ends might be very selfish ones. That is to say, if I can become wealthier or more powerful by doing something that is said to be for the good of your body, but is to the detriment of your soul and therefore also of your body, but I can gain an advantage from it, then I may very well do that, you see. If you are taken in by my presentation of the matter as I'm doing this for your good, and by the way, you should join me in this because that's how, you know, if you're religious, you want to put it in religious terms, that's how you love your neighbor. If you're taken in by that and you begin to comply with policies which actually make it difficult for people to be properly human, can't be with other humans, can't have that conversation at the bar or after church because you're not going to be allowed to go to these places for long stretches of time. When you see policies like that beginning to take hold, not for a few days, not even for a few weeks, but for a few years, months and years, again, you know that there's something malicious happening. There's something evil happening. It's not just the fact that people have lost sight of the uniqueness of the human creature, of the human animal as being rational and volitional in a way that other animals are not. It's not just that you've lost sight of that. It's that you've got some power game going. If nothing else, we know that the authorities suppressed treatments that would have saved even these frail and vulnerable people, many of them, not all of them, but many of them. And they suppressed those treatments because they wanted to get the vaccines going and the vaccination campaigns going. And they knew they couldn't do that if people were in a position to say, well, this pandemic is not actually severe enough to warrant these risks in experimental vaccination campaigns. So they suppressed them. And we know that they did. We know that the treatments work. They don't work for everybody all the time, but they do work pretty well. And so when you, again, see the authorities going to such lengths to hide the truth and to enforce policies which are, for a period of time, killing people. Now, you set aside the question of how many people the vaccines have killed or will kill. We know that many people died unnecessarily because they were not allowed treatment before the vaccines appeared or even afterwards. Again, when you see that, it's not just a matter of, oh, well, I have a different philosophical view of what a human being is, so my policies would look different from yours. It cuts closer to the bone than that. That some of these people do have a very different anthropology, do think that we should be merging the biological with the digital, that this is the time to reinvent man. Some of them do have those ideas, and I'm, you know, I have read or listened to them on it. I know that they have those ideas. I know that it factors into the way they are behaving in this COVID crisis and how they think that the COVID crisis should be used to further their own agenda. At bottom, we can talk more about that because that's all actually very important, and it will be important far past COVID time, which we're almost out of, I hope. when you see people willing to kill people, not directly, but indirectly, maybe directly in the case of those old people in the long-term care homes, but certainly indirectly by denying people life-saving treatments, you know that you're dealing not just with the conflict of anthropologies, but with a conflict of moralities.
And on that point, I'm interested to go more into, again, one of your themes from your recent blog postings around what the response from the church to all of this has been, or perhaps better said, has not been. In one of your blog postings, I mean, you very poignantly captured a sentiment which I know is widespread on the part of many of the faithful, is that in this context over the last couple of years, the church has essentially become a creature of the state. And you and your brethren are feeling that in a very unique way in Quebec with the imposition of the vaccine passport just to get in the door to receive the sacraments. I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little further.
Sure. And of course, it's not just in Quebec that we see that happening. I saw a picture from Perth, Australia, just today, you know, of, as I had seen from England back in the first wave, of a policeman walking into a mass and going around checking people's passports, checking even to see whether their masks were properly worn. And thinking nothing of the fact that this is a holy place and a holy liturgy, a divine liturgy, which is being profaned by the presence of an agent of the state, an enforcement agent. When the church submits to the state on the question of who can go to church and when they can go to church, or whether anyone can go to church, the church has ceded to the state an authority over itself which does not in any way belong to the state. And it has accepted supervision by the state, really governance by the state. The state may not care very much in Canada who is bishop, because it really doesn't matter if the bishops all do what the state tells them. You see, in China, they do care who is bishop, because there's been a large portion of the church that has been underground for quite some time. And the goal was to remove the underground church, to force it up into the surface, and to make sure that it was governed by bishops who would be cooperative with the Chinese Communist Party. To this, the Vatican, alas, agreed and began cooperating, which raises the question of whether the Vatican, as it is operating right now, is operating as a creature of the states, at least of the Chinese state. That's a very difficult question, a very, very important one. Here in Quebec, the bishops were certainly not underground, because they would never do anything that the state didn't approve of. And so the state keeps pushing them further. Whilst opening up other things, it also opens up the church, but it enforces these vaccine passports. And the church has said, oh, well, we're not comfortable with that. We want exemptions from that. But we'll do it. You know, we just want you to know that we're not comfortable and we would prefer to have exemptions. So they put themselves and the Church of God under the authority of the state to decide whether it can meet, how many can meet, who can meet. And in doing so, they divide the church between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, so-called, and create schism in the body of Christ in their own dioceses and parishes. This was the issue on which I finally decided not to be content with publishing in my usual places or even on my academia site, but to go direct to the people, as it were, with Substack, and to resist this, because either the church is a divine institution, yes, also a human institution, but divine in its foundation and in its obligations, and therefore has from God an authority that does not get mediated through the state. Or it isn't. If its authority is, so far as it's divine at all, is mediated by the state, the church itself becomes, you know, you could say in some cases a kind of puppet of the state, but a creature of the state is a better expression for that. The state didn't create it, to be sure, but it becomes a subject of the state like any other creature in the political realm. And that, as far as I can see as a theologian, making an evaluation of this, and it's something, you know, it's in the sphere of my own work over a couple of decades now. This is a denial of the divine nature of the church. Down through the centuries, there have been enormous conflicts between church and state over just such issues. You know, the most famous, I suppose, is the question of who gets to appoint the bishops, the so-called lay investiture controversies. And they have been renewed now in the 20th century, at the end of the 20th century in China, as I was just saying, because essentially the Chinese Communist Party has a say in whether someone is invested as a bishop or not. These are not only lay people, they are atheists.
Yeah.
And even self-idolaters, in the case of Xi Jinping, I would say. So that these people should have the power to help select and decide who gets to be bishop. This is the old struggle reappeared. Now, we thought after a long struggle of centuries for that battle was won. But of course, it has to be won again and again in different contexts and centuries and civilization. So right now it's being very badly lost. It's almost as if all those gains over the previous two millennia have been wiped out in the last 5 years. And COVID is having a major impact on that, because what it is doing is it is showing the colors. It's forcing the bishops to show their colors. And what they're not willing to do in many cases, and in Quebec almost entirely, is they're not willing to tell the state, no, thus far and no further, we have an authority that comes directly from God. You are not the only ones who have divine authority to exercise an office of rule. We also rule in our own sphere, and you do not rule over it. They have neither the theological knowledge nor the moral courage to say that. And consequently, they are just rolling over to the state time and time again. I'm just about to produce another piece for the site in which I will be pointing out that this is a line that once you cross it, you can't uncross it. Of course, you can repent and you can lament the fact that you crossed it, and you can then do courageous things that you didn't do before, but you have already ceded by precedent to the state the power to rule the church. And so it doesn't matter. The state could decide that it's politically convenient to eliminate the passport requirement a fortnight from now. It wouldn't matter. You've already established the precedent that the state decides whether a church meets and who can meet.
You've been making this point in some of your past postings in relation to the vaccine passport. I'm going to quote a couple of sentences. If we do not take a stand here on the matter of passports, we take no stand at all. And elsewhere you wrote, in Quebec today, as in other secular jurisdictions, it is incumbent upon the church and all the faithful to refuse to substitute a vaccination passport for the baptismal certificate. You mentioned that this was the initial trigger for you to start the blog. In one of your first blog postings, you circulated a bit of a summons, a bit of a rallying cry to your brethren in Quebec, essentially to ignore the vaccination passport requirement, given that Christmas was just a couple of weeks away. If you don't mind me asking, what's been the response that you've observed, and how are you personally navigating things? How has this had a personal impact on you and your ability to avail yourself of the sacraments?
Well, so the response is predictably mixed. And in most places, as far as I know, the majority response is very much like the bishops. We just obey the law. We don't even ask whether it's real law or phony law, whether it's constitutionally compatible or whether it's actually a lawless violation of the Constitution. We don't even ask that. What's the problem? Go get vaccinated, get your vax pass, show it at the door, enjoy your nice, warm, comfortable liturgy like you did before, and go back to grumbling about whether it is the liturgy you want or some other liturgy. That's the general attitude as far as I know. But God never leaves his church to that kind of thinking. If a church gets completely like that, it ceases to be the church. So God always has people who are deeper in their faith than that and who will resist. Now, the numbers of those are, you know, a Gideon's army at best in this case. You know, in historical precedent, and especially in the historic precedents, like say in the Nazi era, both in the Protestant and in the Catholic world, you had approximately a third of Christians resisting and two-thirds going along. And that's a very sort of biblical proportion, not at all surprising. Here in Quebec at the present time, I would be astonished if it's as high as a third. Setting that aside, on the practical level, what are those people doing? Well, in our parish, we agreed that, and our pastor agreed, that we must not divide the flock, that that's the one thing we must not do. So we have been meeting for a month and a half outside in the cold, sometimes only 5 or 6 below, sometimes 18 or 19 below. What does that say? Well, it says we are not prepared to challenge the state on the question of who has the right to control who goes into the physical structure of the church. And there's several reasons for that. Some people are in doubt that the physical structures of the church can be fully exempted from state requirements. It'll be interesting to see what their attitude is when the state says you now have to pay taxes on that property, because that's coming pretty quickly, I think. But another reason is that it's very difficult to challenge the state on the parish level if the bishop won't do it and won't back you. But the willingness not to enter the premises, but the unwillingness not to be the church united around Christ and in Christ, that is what has been said in our parish. But of course, there are many who don't know why. Like, as long as the church was closed and you couldn't go in because the government said it was all closed, they're willing to, you know, to sit in their cars and listen on the radio and come out and stand for the Eucharistic liturgy. And indeed, you know, many people kneeling in the snow and so forth. But once the government says you can go in your building now, you know, the fire alarm stopped ringing, you can go in your building, they have no comprehension why you would carry on and leave outside the ones who cannot or will not show a vax pass. So what will come of that response over the next little while remains to be seen. There aren't very many parishes, just as there aren't very many dioceses, where people are so well taught in the faith and so sincere in their faith that they will accept the burden of saying to the state, thus far and no further, So, you know, the bishops, no, the bishops won't. And the church, I am convinced, is in a process of purification, which requires these kind of troubles. And I don't personally think these troubles are going away anytime soon. But the church clearly is in a spiritually disastrous shape. So that's got to be addressed. And these things can't be addressed without trauma.
Everything that you've just said is a great segue into one of the last topics I want to make sure we cover with you, which is the broader issue of obedience and disobedience. In one of your blog postings, in the context of the Vax Pass for Mass, you wrote that you firmly believe civil disobedience in that context is necessary. And here over the last week in Ottawa, we have a very visible, very loud example of civil disobedience in the form of trucks occupying several streets in downtown Ottawa, being joined at different stages by people on foot, by protesters on foot. These are some very challenging questions around the sweet spot in terms of when you disobey and how you disobey. And our church, our faith, certainly gives us some principles and some guideposts in this regard. Jesus's admonition to render unto Caesar, Thomas Aquinas, his teaching on what constitutes a just law and what doesn't. I'd refer our listeners to an earlier episode we did on what Aquinas might have had to say about COVID restrictions. Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, the Catechism of the Church, paragraph 2242. The citizen is obliged and conscious not to follow the directives of civil authorities when they're contrary to the demands of the moral order, to fundamental rights of persons, or the teachings of the gospel. So what's your take on the proper way, the proper time to engage in civil disobedience? Is the Freedom Convoy the answer to that question, or what are the nuances in between there?
One can state principles and then one can try to apply them, but the principles should be the same. The applications will vary. That's a very Thomistic thing to say. The first and most important principle is just captured there in 2242, as you gave it to us. Of course, it takes some level of understanding and discernment to know when a line is being crossed, that civil or positive law is contradicting the moral law or divine law in such a way as to make it impossible for a Christian in good conscience to obey. When you tell people they may not go to give thanks to God, and they may not go and receive sacraments, and they may not go and offer adoration, that's a different matter than saying, well, you know what, we're going to turn your electricity off or your gas off, and you're going to have to do it in the cold if you're really serious about it. Okay, do it in the cold. Stand outside, even if you have to, as we've been doing. But when they say that you can't do it at all, or that these people can do it and other people can't, it seems to me that they have crossed the line, and yes, civil disobedience is called for. Similarly, analogously, with the denial of constitutional rights and freedoms. See, I don't think the church should be arguing the same way the truckers are arguing. Not because I think the truckers are wrong, but because I think the church has to be the church. So the church needs to say, look, we are unique. We are different. We have an authority from God to do what we do, and you do not have authority over us in that matter. So, you know, Vatican II is just as clear about that as Vatican I. And so if you cross that line, we are not going to defend ourselves by arguing about hospitalization statistics or death statistics, or pointing out that really you're skewing these things in a way that is really, really devious. We're not going to argue even on the grounds of, well, Section 2 of the Constitution, you know, gives us these rights and liberties, 6, 7, 15, et cetera. So you and I as citizens can and should argue those things before the courts. The truckers should insist upon them, yes, and say, look, you don't have a right. It's lawless law to take away our mobility rights. Brian Peckford in his suit on this is right to stand up to the government. So you do it at all levels. You do it legally and you do it by nonviolent civil disobedience when it gets to that stage. The church, though, does it on its own basis. If the church is reduced to saying, we have constitutional rights, they're reduced to saying, we're just citizens like any other citizen. Well, yes, you are as a citizen, but as the church, you're something more and other. And if that isn't preserved, if you're not arguing on your own ground, then you're actually, no matter what you win in court, you're denying the nature of the church. So it's different types of argument, but sometimes common kinds of action. I do believe that in the churches, the law ought to be defied about the vaccine passports. I do think that the bishops should have had the courage to do that, and that the people should have had the will to do it, which a few do, but frankly, not a lot. And so the nature of the church, qua church, is threatened here in this situation. You know something else that's happening just very quickly that puts it in an interesting light. The state is not normally sending the policeman around to do it for the state, as in that context that I mentioned in Australia. The state is telling you to do it to yourselves. Now, the bishop is not going to stand at the door, and in most cases, the priest isn't going to stand at the door and say, you can come in, you can't. Who's going to do it?
Yeah, it's the lady.
The lady is going to do it. You're going to have one lay person asking another lay person for private medical information in contravention of the Privacy Act and taking authority over fellow lay people as to whether they can enter the house of God. And the state's sitting back there laughing at you because they don't even have to pay somebody to come around and do this thing that they have ordered. They've ordered you to do it to yourself, and you're saying, okay, where is the church in that? It's not there.
When you phrase it that way, it's even that much more painful and distressing to absorb. There's just one more aspect of the obedience and disobedience angle that I'd love to get your thoughts on. Some folks saying, my body, my choice. You hear that slogan thrown around a lot. Those words will never escape my lips, given their association with the pro-abortion movement. You see a lot of slogans, a lot of signs with the word autonomy being tossed around. I'm just curious to get your thoughts, because I feel the common cause that I share with those folks, the elimination of these restrictions and these mandates, but we certainly don't agree on everything, and we don't agree on some fundamentals, some basic principles about what constitutes freedom. And that's kind of an uncomfortable position to be in. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on all of that, the extent to which we make common cause with these folks. And assuming we ever get to the end of the light at the end of the tunnel and we achieve political objectives, it seems like we have an extraordinary amount of work remaining ahead of us to rebuild virtue, to restore a proper understanding of what freedom is, and to build that civilization of true freedom.
I have said for some time that if we get through this into a place of relative peace, if the program, as I understand it, to take away the freedoms and indeed even the property of the middle and lower classes does not succeed, if the program to force us all into biodigital convergence surveillance type society fails at the present time because of the common resistance that has been put up to it and put up by reason of the grace of God, the church will need to take that opportunity for a fundamental repentance and a new willingness to proclaim to the neighbor, to love the neighbor by proclaiming the gospel of Christ and living it far more authentically. Because if it does not, it will be like the man in the parable who was delivered of a demon and left the house empty. And guess what happened? The demon comes back with six or seven more worse than itself. So the church, first of all, the church is more fundamental than the political and economic society. The church is at the heart of the new humanity, the renewed humanity that God is creating, the humanity that will be the wonderful communion of the city of God. So the church has to take itself with far more seriousness than it has so that it can do its job of proclaiming to the neighbor. Now, that said, the neighbor has a lot of repenting to do too. And one of the things that the neighbor has to ask, the unbelieving neighbor, is how did we ever get to this situation? How did we ever get into this mess in the first place?
Exactly.
And we have to help answer that question. Unfortunately, most of us don't seem to know either. So this prayer and vigil and this is one of the great things about this, by the way, is that people are praying together who weren't doing it before, and who they're doing it in difficult circumstances, and it's helping them, and they're helping one another. Just as when the truckers got together and came to Ottawa, so many of us were encouraged. I was out there too with my wife, you know, waving flags and cheering them through. And it was amazing how many people supported that, not just the truckers, but cars going by.
No, I think that's the real story, to be honest. It's not the truckers, it's the tens and potentially hundreds of thousands of ordinary people on the side of the road on the overpasses. That in my mind is the real story.
And here's another important element of it. Alliances are being made between people, just on an individual level, where people who have been agnostic or been atheist, but have been given by God the grace to see what's going on and to fight it, are finding themselves alongside Christians who also have been given that grace. And bonds are being formed which allow for neighbor love and the mission of the gospel to go forward. This is a great thing. And yes, some of those people are coming from a perspective on the human being that misunderstands what autonomy is, to use the example you used. Misunderstands what it means to respect bodily integrity, so that they, in the past and up to the present, they have assumed that that is something that would be in support of abortion, say. This is a misunderstanding of human autonomy, and it's even a misunderstanding of bodily integrity, because, of course, it leaves out of account the other, namely the fetus. But, and not just the fetus, but especially the fetus. But the distortions in our understanding of human autonomy, so that we mistake the kind of autonomy that the church has always said is diabolical for the good, proper kind of autonomy that belongs to being in the image of God. That all needs to be overcome, absolutely. And it's only, I'm afraid, through such traumas that we even get to a place where we can begin to face those things. And of course, it is the next generation that we are doing this for, and they will need to hear the gospel too. So yes, you're absolutely right that there are some fundamental problems out there about very, very important matters, but things are changing on the ground. We're no longer just going along in a fashion that, you know, the broad way that leads to destruction. We're either getting very close to destruction or we're going to be looking for that narrow gate. This crisis has exposed so much about us, so much about the church, so much about our families, so much about our places of work and our neighbors. But in exposing it, it's also opened up new horizons for blessing and for solidarity in faith and for human flourishing, if we will take them. So, you know, we need to be ready for those changes.
Amen. I cannot think of a more poetic point to end off our conversation. So I'm going to say thank you so much to Dr. Douglas Farrow for being with us. I hope that today's discussion has been faithful to the spirit of desiring a better country. I pray that the fire of your writing and wisdom continues to burn brightly, and that it will continue to help illuminate for us the path towards virtue in this world and salvation in the next. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, and help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.